Welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio, and this is Webster Tarpley in Washington, D.C., and we are now getting, as predicted over the past several weeks, a barrage of calls from the ghouls and jackals and hyenas of the finance establishment. We're getting calls for drastic, draconian, killer austerity against the American people. The big bankers and their stooges at the Federal Reserve Board, led by Helicopter Ben Bernanke, the new Hjalmar Schacht, or he wishes he were the new Hjalmar Schacht, are trotting out their plans for the map austerity turn that they're going to try to impose starting next year with the help of Obama. Remember, Obama has already announced that next year will be the time for austerity. He's got a budget freeze going on all discretionary spending, he says, in federal budget for the following year. So this is now the din, the chorus coming from all of these outlets, including, notice, the right-wing reactionaries who are usually aggressive and calling for counterattacks, the Limbaughs and so forth, are now putting on a demeanor of resignation, highly suspicious resignation in the face of calls for this austerity turn, because this, of course, is the Wall Street policy, and it allows you to operate behind the screen even of the Tea Party, except on certain issues where these people are going to lose. But let's get into it now. In terms of the historical parallels we've been working with, 80 years ago this month, we had the coming of the austerity dictatorship of Heinrich Brüning, the hunger chancellor, to Germany in March and April of 1930. And this is the guy who destroyed the economy and destroyed the political system, opening the door to the National Socialist seizure of power. Let's see where we are in that. But let's now go to Hjalmar Schacht in Dallas. And that would be Bernanke giving his speech in Dallas. And he's talking about the dire situation of the long-term U.S. federal budget. And he is calling for blood, sweat, and tears, naturally from you, not from the financiers that he represents, that control him. Various Wall Street characters, the Diamonds, Pandit the Bandit, Blankfein, Mac, and the rest of these predators. There's not a word about taxing Wall Street turnover. There's no mention of a Wall Street sales tax. Everything else is being taxed, from haircuts to bowling balls and billiard balls, but nothing on the Wall Street sales tax. So let's listen to Bernanke. He says, we're in a dire situation, and we face difficult choices. And let's give it to you in his own words. And I quote the inimitable words of Helicopter Ben Bernanke, speaking in Dallas this past week. To avoid large and ultimately unsustainable budget deficits, the nation will ultimately have to choose among higher taxes, modifications to entitlement programs such as Social Security and Medicare, less spending on everything else from education to defense, or some combination of the above. Higher taxes, as we'll see in a minute, that is going to be the value-added tax or national sales tax, an extremely sinister regressive tax. And I underline the word regressive. It cuts into the necessities of the poor man, the wage earner, the middle class. It attacks the amenities of the middle class, right? The occasional trip to the movies, the occasional bottle of wine, whatever it is. But it leaves the luxuries of Ben Bernanke's super-rich parasitical constituency untouched. So a little touch of class consciousness, you can see right through this. So higher taxes, and he means regressive ones, certainly not the Tobin tax or Wall Street sales tax, which he has never mentioned, which he opposes like the plague. Modifications to entitlement programs, that means gouging your economic rights, taking away your economic rights under Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, unemployment benefits, food stamps, and so on down the line. Social Security and Medicare above all. Medicare, of course, now being gouged by Obama's $500 billion in cuts. There are cuts in Social Security and in the Pentagon's TRICARE for Veterans program, and now they're going to turn to Social Security. They're going to try to take your pension away. Bush tried it under right-wing cover in 2005 and failed, and now it's 2010, 2011, and Barky Obama, the Wall Street puppet, will try it under left cover. Less spending on everything else from education to defense. Wait a minute. Less spending on education? How are you going to be competitive in the world economy of today? We are already falling behind in all the key areas of achievement in the school system if you put less money into education, even as they bust the unions, right? The branch of the American Federation of Teachers here in Washington, D.C., is well on the way to capitulating to the vulture Michelle Rhee, the chancellor of the school system, whose only credential is that she's a union buster, wage gouger. Less spending on everything from education to defense. Well, if you shut down certain defense assembly lines, you're going to be destroying the only high-tech capability you've got left. You've already dropped out of the space race. So what's left? The Chinese are going to get to the moon again before the U.S. So that's Helicopter Ben's line. He wants to have a credible plan to reduce long-term deficits. And this could boost the economy by enhancing the confidence of investors. Oh, enhancing the confidence of investors, those wonderful investors. When they say the market, when they say investors, both of those in quotes, let's remember who that is. It's the bandit, the pirate George Soros. It's the unspeakable gang of thieves at Goldman Sachs. It's Pandit the Bandit at the bankrupt hulk of Citibank. It's Blankfein at Goldman Sachs. It's Mac over at Morgan Stanley. They're steadily bidding up the price of gasoline now. You're getting up towards $3 a gallon in many areas. On the basis of what? On the basis of pure speculation by these resurgent hedge funds and other fly-by-night operations on the London ICE exchange. They're robbing you blind. It's time to attack, counterattack Wall Street, because they've been attacking you for a long time. So the Obama administration says that they are very much aware that the deficits are going to be in the $1 trillion range for the rest of the decade. Helicopter Ben points to Social Security draining resources from the broader federal budget. Wait a minute. What happened to the lockbox, Ben? Ever since the Greenspan reform of Social Security, you'll remember that one, the vast increase of the regressive payroll tax back in 1982, 1983, used to pay for stupid Reagan's tax cuts for the rich and super rich. They turned around, they cut taxes for the super rich, and then they increased taxes in the most regressive way they could so that the burden would fall on working people. That money was supposed to be in a lockbox, Ben. Have you forgotten about the lockbox? Have you forgotten the tremendous debts that are owed to Social Security in the form of Treasury bonds that are held by Social Security? Is that called draining resources when you pay commitment that has been made? Anyway, the double dealing and the duplicity and indeed the economic stupidity of these people is beyond belief. And here's what Ben says. Nothing prevents us from beginning now to develop a credible plan for meeting our long-run fiscal challenges. Indeed, a credible plan that demonstrates a commitment to achieving long-run physical sustainability could lead to lower interest rates and more rapid growth in the near future. Yeah, more rapid growth of derivatives, more credit default swaps, more structured investment vehicles, more collateralized debt obligations, more toxic paper. It's poisonous. The more you have, the poorer you are, and the deader your economy is going to be. Back in a minute. 33, which he wisely boycotted and blocked the British plan to export the depression to every point in the compass. So tarpley.net, you'll also see an essay there about the fall of empire, and the thesis is there's one standard graveyard for empires or great states in general, died of oligarchy. In the case of the Soviet Union, died of nomenklatura oligarchy in that system. The party, government, KGB, and other oligarchs in that system. And, of course, in our system, the oligarchy is financier oligarchy. When they say the market and investors, it means that gang of thieves, Wall Street, whose pictures and names and biographies you should now know. by heart, right? Bernanke works for Diamond, for Blankfein, for Mac, for Pandit the Bandit, and so on down the line. We saw some of them. Again, these characters came out from under their rock for these hearings of the financial investigating committee, right, the one that we've seen this week. We'll get back to that in a minute. So Bernanke wants blood. Bernanke wants to take your economic rights away. You've paid into Social Security and Medicare all your life, and Bernanke wants to cut it. Notice that he can operate to some extent under the cover of anti-government rhetoric. All the people out there saying, down with government, yeah, right, down with Social Security, down with Medicaid, and you come in there as a flanking operation, giving aid and comfort to Wall Street as they attempt to impose their deadly, and I'm talking deadly in the sense of concrete human beings dying, their economic policies. Now, in terms of what to do, well, helpfully, on Tuesday, White House advisor Paul Adolf Volcker, him, the man of the 22% prime rate, highest interest rates in 2,000 years, according to Helmut Schmidt of Germany at the time, Volcker wants higher taxes, but not just any tax. He wants a European-style sales tax known as the value-added tax. What is the value-added tax? Well, in most European countries, it's 17, 18, 19, 20%, which is already included in the price of everything you buy. There's something like this in Canada. I think that's the goods and services tax that was such a horrendous development under Mulroney, the infamous Mulroney, back in the 1990s, in the era, I guess, of Bush the elder. So Volcker wants the VAT, the V-A-T, the value-added tax. And, well, that's deadly. Again, that's a regressive tax. That's a tax that cuts into the necessities of the poor, the amenities of the middle class, and does not touch the luxuries of the super rich. In a modern society, under modern civilization, taxation must be progressive, not proportional even, and certainly not regressive. And this VAT is about the worst thing you can do. So therefore, if you get into arguments with people who want the VAT, you better have a counterargument, and we do. It's called the Wall Street sales tax, the Tobin tax, the securities transfer tax, the financial turnover tax, the trading tax. You can call it whatever you like. It's the Robin Hood tax, and now I have to report that the British election is on. The Gordon Brown regime with Alistair Darling and company, they are going to the voters now. On the other side, David Cameron, the public relations slickster, a Tory reactionary. So we have, in effect, the corporate state with bailouts against the promise of more bailouts, but this time also with an extremely draconian policy. This guy Cameron is another candidate to be a new Bruning. He wants to be an austerity dictator. That's the direction. The only positive thing going on in Britain right now, and I hope that it comes to the fore rapidly, I urge people to get busy over there, it's this Robin Hood tax. It's the Wall Street sales tax, in this case the City of London sales tax, and to the extent that that emerges as a big theme in the British election campaign now over the next 4 weeks, and I'll try to bring you some reporting from the ground if I can, that will then kick over here into the United States, so we'll get an alternative on the table. We want to say no to the value-added tax, tax Wall Street speculative turnover, not even profits. I don't care whether they make profits or losses with their complex models of Black-Scholes derivatives and all the rest of this. They can make up stories that they're losing money. No, no, no. We want to tax turnover. If you sign a derivatives contract, that's reportable. 1% goes into the public till. So the bankers pay for depression, which they have created. So we've heard from Bernanke. He wants blood. Volcker, another little Kalmar Schacht of our time, he wants the value-added tax. And now let's not forget another little Bruning, this time the one with his helicopter beanie with a propeller on it, Peter Orszag, director of the White House Office of Management and Budget. Let me just read what the Wall Street Journal says about him on Thursday. The administration, they paraphrase, has taken steps towards deficit reduction by signing a health care overhaul with a commission meant to rein in Medicare costs. Ooh, a commission meant to rein in Medicare costs. Gosh, that is IMAC or Super MedPAC, or both, depending on how they actually institute this chaotic bill. The medical council is this IMAC. This is the idea. This is to tell you which medical technologies are considered cost effective. That is to say, will they pay for you? Will you live? Will you die? Surprise! It's a death board. It's a death panel. It's genocide. They gave $1 trillion to the banks from the Treasury, and between the Treasury, the FDIC, and the Federal Reserve, it's thought to be in the neighborhood of about $24 trillion, according to the most recent accounting. And now they're turning around and saying, "Well, we gave Wall Street what they needed. And now we're gonna essentially pay that debt off by taking blood and the lives of the American people." And that's Orszag. That is his specialty. This is the guy who wants no pap smears, no mammograms, no PSA tests, no medical tests in general. Orszag has declared war on medical tests. And that's what the IMAC, or MedPAC on steroids, is going to do. And Orszag then goes on to say that Obama has created this fake commission. This is now the Erskine Bowles Al Simpson commission that will make recommendations for deficit cuts. And he says this is necessary but not sufficient. So hold on to your hats. It's pointing time, an austerity dictatorship of the most brutal type. Back in a minute.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Webster Tarpley in Washington, D.C., urging you to keep up with the various articles and commentaries, some of them from Russia Today, where I do appear from time to time. You can get all of that at tarpley.net, and of course it's all for free. Let's just remember now, the predecessor of Helicopter Ben is, of course, Bubbles Greenspan. These are two little Kalmar Schachts left over from Weimar, Germany. Greenspan had been hauled in front of this Angelides Commission. That is the commission that's investigating the causes of the crash, right, of the banking panic of 2008. And this, of course, is a moment to assign guilt. There's war guilt, right, and then there's depression guilt. Depression guilt attaches to Greenspan big time, especially because he is one of the people who insisted not only that derivatives not be banned or regulated, but that they not even be reportable, that it was okay to have secret derivatives contracts, over-the-counter derivatives, contracts made in secret between counterparties, among counterparties, that would not even be reportable to the government. So ultimately, nobody knows the amount, this crushing burden of the derivatives bubble. I work with the, and have been working with the estimate, $1.5 trillion worth of derivatives worldwide in existence at any given time. And you can thank Greenspan for that. And the person that tried to get them made reportable was, of course, Brooksley Bourne, who in 1998-1999 was the Clinton appointee at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and she wanted to make them reportable, and she was blocked by Robert Rubin of Citibank, by Larry Summers, currently hanging on in the Obama White House, although reports are that he might leave, and by Greenspan. So Brooksley Bourne gets the moment of vindication and puts Bubbles Greenspan on the spot, telling him, quote, The Fed utterly failed to prevent the financial crisis. The Fed and the banking regulators failed to prevent the housing bubble. They failed to prevent our biggest banks and bank holding companies from engaging in activities that would bring them to the verge of collapse. And I think that's pretty much what she says. She manages to say fail 9 times in a series of questions. Did not the Federal Reserve, she asks, did not the Federal Reserve system fail to meet its responsibilities to carry out its mandates? Yes, of course. And we get Angelides into the act. My view is you could have, you should have, and you didn't. It would be nice if Angelides filled in what he should have done. So, obviously, Greenspan squirming. He's already said that his metaphysical idolatry, totemic fetishism of markets that he learned from the fascistoid Ayn Rand, that this his faith in the infallibility of markets has now been slightly shaken. But, of course, he comes back with this impudent story, the reactionary legend about the Depression. This is sort of the, you know, in the 1920s, the German reactionaries had the stab in the back, right? The stab in the back that they had been betrayed. Well, this is the legendary explanation for the Depression, is what Greenspan says. Greenspan seeks to lay the blame for the crisis on the fact that domestic political pressures were exercised to boost home ownership. And he says the main cause of the Depression are the congressionally chartered mortgage companies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, which were major consumers of subprime mortgages. Yeah, fine. They had been privatized, dear Bubbles. They worked fine as long as they were government entities, parts of the U.S. government, government agencies. They were then privatized, so they kept a congressional charter and an implicit guarantee of Treasury backup. But they were then being run for money by the likes of the predator Franklin Reins and other characters operating under left cover from the Clinton administration. And he says, the pressures on me at the Fed to enhance lending were remarkable. So you see the idea. Poor judgment, a human failure, derivatives, as Brooks Lieborn says, the lack of regulation meant that derivatives could generate much larger risks than regulated financial products such as insurance. But Greenspan, basically, his story is the Democrats forced us to make home loans to poor people on the marginal or slum properties, and those subprime mortgages then defaulted, and that brought down the world banking system. And this is simply an idiotic, obscene joke that no serious person could entertain for 2 seconds. Nevertheless, you turn on Limbaugh, and that is what you will be told is the cause of the Depression, caused by the government, of course, not by 1.5 quadrillion in derivatives issued, not by the government, but by the various bandits of the zombie banks of Wall Street. Now, the question, therefore, is, we now have Greenspan, discredited, odious, contrite in some ways, but arrogant in others. And he basically says, well, at various times I was wrong. He said that at least before. And Bernanke comes forward 2 months after getting more negative votes than anybody in history, and he's now dictating what the rest of the U.S. government should do. And, of course, he's really unelected and unaccountable. He operates in secret, doesn't want to be audited, and all the rest of that. So this must change. And what you would need is somebody to say to Bernanke, look, Bernanke, we are ordering you by law to issue $1 trillion of 0% federal credit for production only, not for your banking friends, no banks, no insurance companies, no investment banks, no hedge funds, none of that, no money market funds, nothing based on paper. We're going to build 50,000 miles of maglev, 100 reactors of the most modern type. We're going to build 1,000 modern hospitals. We're going to rebuild the interstate highway system, and we're going to rebuild our water systems, the sewage system, canal system, irrigation, and all the rest of it. We're going to do the Tennessee Valley Authority treatment for every river valley in the U.S. that still hasn't had it and beyond. And you're going to do that, and that's the law. So don't tell us about your policy that you make in secret with your buddies there from Pandit the Bandit and Diamond and Blankfein. So this is now the problem. How can we take orders from Bernanke when we see the man behind the curtain of the past era there, Greenspan, the architect of the bubbles? He has to come in and get a lambasting and a tongue lashing from the people who were right on various things when he was completely wrong. Now, therefore, remember, the answer to this stuff is, on the one hand, the Tobin tax, the Robin Hood tax, the Wall Street sales tax, that's the tax we need. No VAT, no sales tax, nothing regressive. We want to tax the banks. And the way you tax the banks, hedge funds and investment banks, of course, included, that is on their turnover, which right now is not touched. No tax on it. There's nothing discriminatory, nothing vindictive about this. Some people even say, yeah, if you're in New York, you should pay the 8% sales tax or whatever it is that everybody else pays when they have to go and buy a piece of consumer electronics or whatever it is. And that's a perfectly good position. Bring that position into the debate. Is nothing discriminatory. Now, shifting gears, let us see how new bubbles may emerge. They are emerging around Greece. We just had the Fitch Financial Rating Agency downgrade the government bonds, the state debt of Greece, to BBB. So it's not AAA, it's not AA, it's not A, it's BBB. So it's BBB, and that's not so great. They're going to have to pay a whole lot more. Now, let me hasten to point out, Fitch, Moody's, and these people, they should all be in jail based on what they did in 2008. They shouldn't be rating countries. They should be sitting in jail commenting on the food that they get from these countries. Back in a minute on World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley in Washington. So we're looking at Greece. Now, the troubles have returned, meaning the attack by Soros, Soros Fund Management, the rest of those people at that idea dinner in the beginning of February, the various participants that you can see listed there at tarpley.net. Headline of the Wall Street Journal this morning, Friday, April 9th, Greek bond crisis spreads. Now, what's behind this, of course, is Fitch has downgraded Greek bonded debt, the government debt, to BBB. And remember, Standard & Poor's, Moody's, Fitch, they should all be in jail. They should have been shut down and their people indicted and sent to the clink after 2008 when they were telling everybody right up to the last minute on Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, these are reputable companies. Your investments are in good hands. A complete failure of these characters. These are essentially politically motivated hitmen, economic hitmen, financial hitmen of the Anglo-American banking cabal. So, Greek bond crisis spreads. The great fear is back because some of the largest banks in Greece on Wednesday of this past week turned to the Greek government, essentially asking for a bailout. Surprise. They hate government except when they want to get bailed out by it. Free market is a wonderful ideology as long as you don't take it seriously, because when you're on the verge of bankruptcy, you will turn to the only institution powerful enough to save you, which is government in this case. So the Greek banks turned to the government on Wednesday and asked for access to an emergency government liquidity facility, meaning money, meaning a bailout. So we have a quote in the Wall Street Journal, BNP Paribas, bank that has dabbled in derivatives. They've been on the verge of collapse themselves. They say this is a sign that the Greek government needs to make a phone call to the International Monetary Fund. In other words, bring in the vultures and the jackals who will impose conditionalities, a letter of intent, and even worse austerity than you've got already. Basically, the destruction of the country, right? The destruction of Greek civilization, which nobody's been able to do so far. Maybe the IMF can do it. The form now that it takes is, first of all, on the Greek government bonds, the Greeks have to pay 6 2/3% more to borrow money than does Germany. Germany considered the benchmark sort of standard borrowing rate in Germany, the equivalent of a U.S. Treasury bond, or what used to be that equivalent. The Greeks have to spend 6 2/3% more to borrow money, but now the banks, I won't go through all these banks, but the most dramatic is the number two bank in Greece. This is called EFG Eurobank Ergasias. EFG Eurobank Ergasias lost 8% yesterday, Thursday, April 8th. And other banks taking a huge dive. So this is now another round of the Soros and Goldman Sachs attack. And the way that they do it has been outlined in the Wall Street Journal of the previous day, which is that they're using credit default swaps. They're using derivatives. And the way that the Wall Street Journal puts this, this is now Rupert Murdoch dictating the contents of the news pages, not just the reactionaries and arch reactionaries of the editorial page, but the news page. Investors playing defense heighten Greek debt woes. So now it's not those bad guys from Soros and Goldman Sachs. It's normal industrial companies. It's Coca-Cola Company and Dole Pineapple Company, Dole Food Company. They see a weakening euro. They're trying to use credit default swaps and swaps in general to try to protect themselves from losses. And this is driving up the risk premium. This is making it tougher and tougher for the Greeks to borrow money. And again, what the Greeks would need to do is to impose a Tobin tax of at least 1% on all derivatives, including credit default swaps. You want to have any derivative that's going to have any application to any Greek national issue of bonds or anything like that, you slap a Tobin tax on it. You take 1 or 2%, take 5%. And that takes the life out of the booze right away. That will scare off Soros and the rest of these jackals in short order. Unfortunately, the fact that the Greeks are locked into the euro means that they can't do the other obvious thing, which is credit controls and capital controls, exchange controls. Capital controls, exchange controls first, to prevent hot money from coming in and out and attempting to collapse the currency, because this country is now under attack. And this morning, CNBC showed you that the situation in terms of debt is actually Japan is approaching 200% of its gross domestic product in terms of accumulated debt. Italy, about, I guess, 150%. And then you get some other places. Iceland makes the list, and so forth. It's time for governments to fight back. The only question is, will the jackals and hyenas of Soros and Goldman Sachs, Citibank, and the rest of them, will they succeed in bankrupting the modern state, or will the modern state fight back and put these predators where they belong, either in jail or in court? Because simply, you enforce the tax laws, enforce the existing antitrust laws, stop bailouts, you essentially have these people going down. Because that's the irony is that they're essentially wards of the state that are biting the hand that feeds them. In a free market, they would have long since ceased to exist. So now, that's the European picture. Geithner has been in China. You can see a commentary by me from the latter part of the week, this past week, on Geithner in China. This is, again, the policy of exporting depression, beggar my neighbor, competitive devaluation. They're going to demand that the renminbi go up 40%, which means, again, that the dollar goes down 40%. That's competitive devaluation. What they should be thinking of doing in a rational world is to say, well, we have this island of stability between the U.S. and China, that a renminbi equals 6.8 renminbi equals a dollar. Why don't we try to build in the euro, the yen, the ruble, the Latin American regional currency, Arab currency, if that occurs, and try to get a regime of fixed parity so we would be taking the steps back towards the successful Bretton Woods system and away from the chaotic and destructive and failed floating rate system, which has now been operating for about four decades since the collapse of Bretton Woods on August 15, 1971, destroyed by Nixon, Kissinger, George Shultz, and others. But no, they don't do that. The Chinese realize that if they allow the renminbi to go up, they will, even if it's just 3 or 4%, that will bankrupt a part of their export economy. The Chinese export companies subsist on profit margins, which are often very thin, and if their if their prices go up in foreign markets, they will be priced out by even cheaper sweatshops in places like Vietnam or Thailand or even further down the line. So that is going to cause unemployment. Unemployment means the possibility of social unrest, turbulence, mass strikes, with the Anglo-Americans fanning the flames, needless to say. So the Chinese would be well advised to get themselves out of this. As long as they have between $1 and $2 trillion worth of treasury papers, I say on Russia Today, you're really in a bad situation, because if you're depending on the U.S. consumer market, that's no good. The dollar, well, those treasury bonds, if you keep them and just hold them, they're likely to dwindle in value. If you dump them, they will crash in value. So why don't you do something constructive? First of all, spend some of that money on yourself. Build a few thousand hospitals in rural China. Start attacking the problems of longevity and standard of living in rural China. And then a Marshall Plan for Africa in the form of a Sino-African Development Bank. Put $1 trillion in that and start developing Africa, and you will kick the IMF and the U.S. out of Africa. Do it that way. We'll be back on World Crisis Radio.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
News Brief brought to you by the International News Net.
Alan Greenspan, former head of the Federal Reserve, defended his role Wednesday in the lead-up to the global financial crisis, blaming investors' appetite for high-risk subprime mortgages for contributing to the economic meltdown. Spain's most high-profile judge, Baltasar Garzon, faces trial on charges of overreaching his powers by launching an inquiry into the regime of General Francisco Franco. A magistrate ruled Wednesday he had acted without jurisdiction. Garzon is famous for targeting Augusto Pinochet and Osama bin Laden. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke warned Wednesday Americans may have to accept higher taxes or changes in Medicare and Social Security if the nation is to avoid staggering budget deficits that threaten to choke off economic growth.
This news brief brought to you by the International News Net.
When conservative activists James O'Keefe and Hannah Giles released tapes last fall purporting to show Acorn employees advising them how to set up a child prostitution ring, it resulted in congressional defunding of the anti-poverty group. But it's now clear the O'Keefe expose was a lie. The edited video released by O'Keefe appears to show an Acorn employee advising him on how to smuggle underage girls into the U.S. But in the previously unreleased portion of the video, the Acorn employee continues asking very detailed questions about O'Keefe's phone number and the exact time and location of the girl's arrival. According to California Attorney General Jerry Brown's report, quote, immediately after the couple left, the employee phoned his cousin, Detective Alejandro Hernandez, at the National City Police Department, saying a self-admitted prostitute had been to the office and was discussing human smuggling.
This news brief brought to you by the International News Net.
After the worst coal mining disaster in 25 years, Massey Energy CEO Don Blankenship faces scrutiny for his record of putting coal profits over safety and health. Blankenship, a right-wing activist millionaire who sits on the boards of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Mining Association, used his company's ties to the Bush administration to paper over Massey's blatant environmental and health violations. Massey rewarded Republicans with massive donations after the company avoided paying billions in fines for a 2000 coal slurry disaster in Martin County, three times bigger than the Exxon Valdez. After mine inspectors and Massey employees got the message it was more important to, quote, run coal than to follow safety rules, a deadly fire broke out in the Aracoma Alma mine in 2006, burning two men alive.
Welcome back to the second hour of this week's edition of World Crisis Radio, and has now become customary. We're going to try to catch up with Phil Berg, distinguished attorney in Philadelphia and the founder of the movement and the series of law cases that bear on the constitutional ineligibility of Obama, the question of his birth certificate never produced and his possible then transfer of allegiance to Indonesia and everything that goes with it. And I know that now that the season is changing here, it may be the time for some political activity, and I wonder if Phil has anything to tell us in that regard.
Absolutely. How are you?
Great.
Breaking news. We have set a date, and hopefully your listeners will spread the word, and we can get as many people as possible in Washington on Saturday, May 29th. That's the Saturday of Memorial Day weekend from 12 noon to 4 p.m. at the Ellipse, which is right behind the White House. It's also called the President's Park South. It's right behind the White House. And we're putting out, we have a permit. We're now putting out, actually, our flyer for it. We, after consultation, we decided to change the name. We're emphasizing, you know, different things here. We're calling it now the Obamacare, Obama Eligibility March on Washington. Obamacare, Obama Eligibility March on Washington. And we're saying that because the eligibility, we have stated many times that because of the birth certificate and adoption, they fall under the eligibility. He does not meet the requirements of being natural born in accordance with Article 2, Section 1 of the United States Constitution. But the health care bill, which we're calling, and many others are calling it the Obamacare, signed into law by Obama March 23rd, is unconstitutional and voidable. Now, it's voidable when we ascertain that Obama is a usurper and cannot be in the position of president. So we're moving ahead on these areas, and we can spread the word. We can have an enormous showing in Washington, D.C. that Saturday with a basic message to Obama, either show that you're eligible to be president or resign from office. We're asking people to bring copies of their birth certificate. They can get further details if they don't have it yet off our website, which is obamacrimes.com, obamacrimes.com. And also I want to thank you, Webster, for giving me help to get this thing going. So we're hoping that...
And it's a great time to have it. Go ahead.
At the top of our flyer, we have Obama speaking, you know, during his campaign. In the background, it says change that we can believe in, and we added the caption underneath, this is not the change we believe in. Obama has set this the course for this country in the past 15, 16 months on a course for destruction. He's really set us up for a socialist country. This Obamacare bill is horrific. The taking over of the banks, the taking over of General Motors, we are on the road for a socialist country, which is not what the people in the United States deserve, are entitled to, and should expect.
Well, I got to quibble with you on this one. This is not socialism. This is the Mussolini fascist corporate state, and it's an important distinction. So maybe we can.
Okay, we'll talk on that.
Disagree that one, but that's
well. No, everybody. Whatever Webster said, Webster is true on this. Webster is the expert in that area. But let me ask you, no matter what we call it, is this a good direction for our country, Webster?
No, it's a disaster, and I've just been going through it. But I would call it the corporate state, and that's I think, the relevant parallel. But go ahead.
So what we need to do is have a terrific showing. People can spread the word out there now. We've gotten other groups that are going to join on with sponsorship. I've had a lot of calls from members of the Tea Parties. We now have this flyer out there, which people can download and print it and hand it out at they expect 800 Tea Party events next week. So we're asking people who can download the flyer, make copies, and hand them out so that we can have a tremendous showing in Washington, D.C., and basically to tell Obama we're not going to take it anymore. Either prove you're legit or resign from office. Remember, when Nixon didn't go down because of the break-in in Watergate, he went down because of the cover-up of the break-in. Well, Obama now is in office like 15, 16 months, and what do we have? We have a massive cover-up of the fact that he is constitutionally ineligible to be president of the United States. And it's time now. We want a peaceful revolution. We want peace. want the American public to spread this word around. This is very imperative for people to take the flyer off our website if they don't get it direct and spread it to everyone in their address book and ask them to spread it on and on and on. I'm going to be doing a videotape in the next couple of days, and we'll put that up on the Internet as well regarding this issue, because there's nothing more critical than enforcing our U.S. Constitution. And I've said that now for 16 months, actually longer than that. I've said that going on. August will be 2 years. I stated way back when, if I'm wrong, Obama, show me I'm wrong. But he hasn't. He spent over $1.6 million fighting my lawsuits, other lawsuits. And it really is a disgrace what is going on. And we're doing everything in our power to really stop Obama at this point.
So let me ask you a couple of things now. In terms of assembling a united front of groups of all types, and I think, you know, you have conservatives, but you're also going to have some left liberals now who are beginning to get disaffected and maybe coming over themselves. Do you have any groups? I think you told me that you've already got one group that has come on board and they're helping to organize.
Well, we're waiting with that particular board. I can't mention it. We're waiting till Monday for their trustees to meet on their group, we're for sure we're going to get that endorsement. I think we're going to get a lot of groups coming forth. And the big issue here is we will take the input from anyone. We don't have to all agree on each minute point, but we have to agree overall. Overall, Obama is constitutionally ineligible to be president. There's overwhelming circumstantial evidence on that, and I think it's Obama's obligation to show otherwise.
Right.
And then on Obamacare, where some people are talking about some sections are good, which they are, the overall thrust of it is poor. No one, companies are stopping in their tracks at this point, major companies, to see what it's going to cost them. There's tremendous taxes. The taxes are going to be imposed on businesses starting this year, but the benefits to people, most benefits, won't be seen for 4 years.
And let me add, $500 billion cut out of Medicare, the single worst and most ominous thing. And as I was just going through, ORSAG is now boasting that there's a commission in there that's going to realize savings, and that's the death board. That's the death panel. No way around it.
Now, and just think about it. If you take $500 billion from Medicaid, who's going to – where's that going to get covered? That's to help pay for this no program. If you take $500 billion, benefits are going to get cut. Something's got to get cut, and or your the co-op – I can't think of the right name. When you go to a doctor, the amount – your co-op fee you have to pay, the co-pay fee.
Sure.
That's going to go up. I mean, this thing is ludicrous. You can't say, and they say, well, we're going to take $500 billion and we're going to clean up the problems. Well, the real way to do it is clean up the problems and then, you know, deal with the money situation. They're doing everything backwards here. It's outrageous. I guess you saw who just announced his resignation today from Shupak. I might be wrong on his name. He decided that he's not going to run for re-election at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder what the cash payoff was to him to come forth on this issue.
Well, better yet, I think with Rahm Emanuel, it's more like the threats, right? We saw with Congressman Massa, he was directly threatened. Rangel was threatened. Conyers, I believe, threatened. So, again, I think the really objectionable thing is that's a bailout of insurance companies now by you. In other words, the average person is forced to shell out money directly to a predatory, private, for-profit, deregulated insurance company. So I don't see it as a takeover, a government takeover of health care. It's the private insurance companies and Wall Street, which is what they are, taking over the federal government, and that's the corporate state.
Well, the big thing is everyone comes Saturday, May 29th,
absolutely,
to Washington, D.C.
Okay, wonderful. So ObamaCrimes.com, and we'll see you next week, Phil, and we'll have a progress report now every week until the big day.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay, see you soon.
Okay.
We'll be back in
3 days. America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Thank you. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. That's Phil Berg, ObamaCrimes.com. And remember, those of you who are coming at this from the left liberal side or the peace movement side, if you have a president who cannot produce a birth certificate, he is blackmailable. He's not your president. He's the president of whoever can blackmail him with the knowledge that he has no birth certificate. So that is intolerable. And maybe that explains why the constituencies that Obama pandered to are now so disappointed, because he didn't pander to them. He didn't do anything. And in particular on the war, the sellout to the private insurance companies and Big Pharma in the health bill, and then also the other things that he's done. The article here in the Washington Post, he's offended a list of constituencies, unions, women, LGTB, and so on down the line. Nobody satisfied with Obama. Well, yes, he's a Wall Street puppet. And one of the mechanisms of being a Wall Street puppet is that you're blackmailable. So that's, I think, a way to look at this. And it's got to be clarified, because otherwise you've got a constitutional crisis, which is what you have right now. Now, let's go through foreign affairs in a couple of segments. First of all, the coup in Kyrgyzstan, what is this? It is clear that Russia is winning in Kyrgyzstan. Putin has been on the phone with the new prime minister, Otunbayeva. Otunbayeva, going back to the Soviet era as a diplomat, a veteran politician. Her connections all go to the Russian and Soviet sides. And Putin has said now that this guy Bakiyev, the president who has been ousted, Putin says that Bakiyev stepped on the same kind of rake as his unfortunate predecessor, Akayev, who was driven out in the color revolution, the tulip revolution of 2005, right after the Ukrainian orange people power coup, color revolution. This guy, Akayev, had said, well, we're not going to have that here. And then NATO intelligence and the CIA and so forth turned around and hit him with a people power coup that brought in Bakiyev. There are regional tensions. Bakiyev is from the underdeveloped south. The more cultured and more advanced northern part of Kyrgyzstan is much more Moscow-oriented. Russia says that they did not instigate the coup. Well, we don't know, but we can see that they seem to be winning. At the beginning, the new government said that they were going to oust the U.S. from Manas Air Force Base, which is the key logistics hub for the war in Afghanistan. Now they renegotiated. That would be a chance for this new government to oust the U.S. from that base. There's tremendous resentment against the Pentagon, because the Pentagon entered into Iran, where they were getting $50, $60, $70 million a year in rake-offs. From the, maybe that was the rake that Putin is talking about. They stepped on the same rake-off on this Air Force base. So it means that the U.S. position in Central Asia is collapsing. This is an example. It may indeed be that some of these rebellions were spontaneous, but God knows they don't stay spontaneous very long, and I'm always skeptical about spontaneity. It can't be excluded. The Russians are there at the Kant Air Force Base. So it looks like, again, the Russians gaining ground as the U.S. puppet Bakiyev falls, and this base is now up in the air, whether that's going to be there. Then we get the satrap. We've got Fuad. In Central Asia, yes, indeed, but he doesn't really go into the China side of things very much. The U.S. wants a little bit more hesitant in branding them. What we have this week is that after saying that the U.S. thug. Did vote the U.S. wants to make him into a puppet, that the U.S. is an occupying force along with NATO, and he would like to join remember that Eikenberry, as well as Galbraith, right, the U.S. ambassador, former general Eikenberry, along with Peter Galbraith, had been strongly anti-Karzai. Galbraith now says that Karzai is a drug addict and that he's been using too much of the heroin production of Afghanistan. Ooh, that is hurting. And then, look, people are being asked to fight and die for this regime. It's time to get out. It's time to liquidate this entire insane thing, because the with the decline of the U.S. imperial position, it becomes harder and harder to maintain these extremely advanced outposts of empire. Ukraine has now announced that there will be no joining of NATO. Even the commission to study it has now been abolished by the new president, Yanukovych. The whole crew of Orange Revolution NATO agents and IMF agents has been ousted. So China gaining in Afghanistan, Russia gaining in Kyrgyzstan, even though Kyrgyzstan has a long border with Russia. Now, in terms of the basic strategy as we go into this nuclear stuff, remember, Obama is supposed to be Neville Chamberlain, but Neville Chamberlain properly understood. In other words, he is somebody who is a posture of studied appeasement, a studied weakling, with the idea then that you're going to get other people to fight while you hang back on the edges and laugh and benefit and pick up the pieces. And that is the so-called tertius gaudens. And the strategy, I guess, in U.S. geopolitical parlance is buck passing. The idea is play Russia and China against Iran, if at all possible. Play Iran against Russia and China. This hasn't been working very well. The color revolution in Iran is now obviously a failure. But still, the idea is nice to Russia, try to be nice to China if you can, and try to lock them into a course of confrontation with Iran. Now, be nice to Russia would be the U.S.-Russia START II treaty. Everybody comes down to 1550 warheads. Medvedev and Obama signed it this week. We'll look at this in more detail, but it's essentially a gesture of this type. It's a very shaky deal. Foreign Minister Lavrov of Russia has already said if the U.S. starts building anti-ballistic missile defenses outside of this treaty, which only covers the offensive side of weapons, then the treaty may have to be liquidated. There's also some question about getting it through the Senate, right? Will the Republicans try to block it in the Senate? Certainly for this year, we can forget about it. This will become an issue at a later point. And we'll talk about Obama's nuclear strategy here in a minute when we come back on World Crisis Radio.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. So we've got the U.S. START II treaty signed by Obama and Medvedev, and the inevitable optimism, I guess, around this. I'm thinking of the spirit of Locarno, 1925, right, that was going to bring essentially peace in our time. Didn't work. Especially arms control treaties are a very, very unstable basis for anything. Obama has now announced his new nuclear strategy. The U.S. will not use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear states who attack with chemical and biological weapons unless those non-nuclear states are branded by the U.S. as not observing the non-proliferation treaty or otherwise are exempted. So basically a meaningless statement. Again, this is all window dressing. This is to try to get some cover for a policy of attempting to strangle the economic development of Iran and prepare the breakup of Iran under the cover of nuclear nonproliferation and the fight against nuclear terrorism. I would, in addition to all the obvious points that have been made about this by all kinds of people, the idea that the U.S. is talking about the non-proliferation regime, the NPT, Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, is an obscene joke. because the U.S.-India nuclear deal is already a complete violation that throws this entire non-proliferation regime out the window. So the biggest violator is now going to be judging who is in conformity with the NPT and who is not. And they say Iran is not in conformity with the NPT. Well, that's not what the International Atomic Energy Agency says, even under the ambiguous character Amano, certainly not under El-Baradei. Do we have any statement in that direction? So then we're going to have this photo opportunity summit, which, again, 47 countries. Medvedev, I guess, is going to be here. President Hu of China will come. Netanyahu will not come because he thinks that the Muslim countries will gang up on him as a nuclear weapons state. The idea, again, same thing. Get some credibility so that you can beat Iran over the head on nuclear issues. And, of course, for who, it costs him nothing to come. I'm just wondering, if you look at what Chinese Prime Minister Wen did at Copenhagen with this masterful blocking of the Anglo-American attempt at installing a worldwide carbon dictatorship to strangle the development of India, China, and the rest of the third world. Look at what Wen did in Copenhagen. Is that what Hu might do in Washington, D.C.? In other words, prevent the formation of a lockstep under U.S.-British domination with French help from Sarkozy against Iran. That'll be interesting to see. Because he's not just going to be a potted plant. He's going to be an active participant. We've also got the U.S. now getting China to discuss sanctions against Iran. The Chinese had not been willing to discuss it, and they're still not even willing, as far as I can see. Foreign Ministry in Beijing is not willing to confirm that China is discussing sanctions against Iran. This had started when Sarkozy came to town, this wounded demagogue. After losing his regional elections, he started posturing with Obama about how bad Iran was, trying to give himself some profile in that regard. And now China is talking. Well, you know, they may talk for a long time. They may have joined these talks to sabotage them, to delay them, to dilute, to delay, and all the other obvious things. So they'll take the long view there, too. A lot of hysteria in the Anglo-American press this past week about China supports Iran sanctions, has not happened. China agrees to float renminbi, also has not happened. We've also got, when Geithner was in India, he celebrated that U.S.-Indian alliance, that, again, clear violation of the non-proliferation treaty regime. We're having in Iraq, the U.S., with power of the U.S. collapsing everywhere across the world, the U.S. puppet Alawi is not able so far to form a government against Maliki, who comes on the scene as a Iranian-backed and indeed Chinese-backed candidate. And we've now got Muqtada Sadr of the Mahdi army, the Shiites of the lower Euphrates, coming on in support of Jafari, the other guy who has been prime minister so far. We've got all three of them, all three of the prime ministers post-Saddam now contending for the prime minister's office. And I think it's a sign that, again, U.S. position not very strong. More reality, as usual, comes from the man with a mind like a rag bag who periodically blurts out things that he's heard in his briefings, which he's not supposed to say in public. Biden now says nuclear war has never been more likely than today because of nuclear terrorism. And that is what Obama is actually going to be up to on the 12th and 13th next week with the Nuclear Weapons Security Summit here in Washington, D.C. So, concerning the Middle East, I've said this a number of times here, but you can now see it in the Washington Post. Column by David Ignatius this past Wednesday, April 7th, Obama's Middle East plan, and it's what I've said, it is to assemble an Arab-Sunni front against Iran. And the critical thing is that the solution of the Israeli-Palestinian contention, the two-state solution so-called, is intimately linked to the attempt to contain, reduce, break up Iran. These are basically the same policy. It's not to say to Israel, you've just got to make a deal with the Palestinians. It's to say, you can make a deal with the Palestinians because you should really be worrying about Iran. So make a deal with the Palestinians, even with the PLO and with Hamas, because then we're going to proceed to use that as a springboard to get the Arabs and the Sunnis lined up against Iran, even as we go for sanctions, and that will take away your biggest problem perceived by people like Netanyahu. So the Obama policy is a war policy, and we're told by Ignatius that Netanyahu, under the cover of all of this brouhaha, right, the big diplomatic clashes and the dinner invitation that he didn't get, that Netanyahu is seriously considering an American peace plan to resolve the Palestinian conflict because it's linked to some idea of taking out Iran, but using these Arab and Sunni proxies as the way to do that. In other words, don't you Israelis fight Iran. Let's use the Arabs and the Sunnis in the first line, and let's use them up. Let's get them chopped to pieces against the Iranians. So that is a policy likely to lead to war. And if you look across the world, Thailand is also in a state of emergency. We'll look at the internal Thai situation. It's always got to do in Thailand between pro-Chinese forces and U.S. forces that are mainly anti-Chinese, anti-trade, and so forth in their general orientation. So now we're going to switch gears now. We've got to take a couple of steps backward, and we've gone through this big austerity push coming from Volcker, from Bernanke, from Orsag, ultimately from Obama, right, because he's going to become the austerity man next year. If you have a situation where Obama starts turning around and saying, I'm now going to cut the main form of social insurance, Social Security, here in the United States, you are back once again to 80 years ago. The Hermann Müller government of the SPD Social Democrats in Germany, who fell 80 years ago on an issue of cutting social insurance in the form of unemployment benefits. And we'd just like to get back to the Weimar comparison in a minute on World Crisis Radio.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Now, here in our last segment, let's go through some comparisons. We now have Bernanke, Volcker, Orsag, the various ghouls and enforcers of drastic, draconian, lethal austerity against the American people. Balance the budget. Balance the budget. Herbert Hoover, 1931. Herbert Hoover, 1932. Balance the budget, have what amounts to an attempted deflationary policy. Of course, today we've got the worst of both. We've got hyperinflation or inflation at some levels in terms of things like medical insurance and college tuition and other expenses. And then we've got deflation when it comes to factory closings and 7% of the U.S. workforce now productive in the sense that they're working in factories and manufacturing goods. It doesn't work. And we can say it doesn't work because this whole thing has been tried. Exactly what Volcker and Bernanke and Orsag are demanding is the policy of Heinrich Brüning in the Weimar Republic from March of 1930, 80 years ago now, and about July of 1932. And if you go back, I want you to go back and become somehow familiar with at least some of the main features of this time, because it's on the basis of this that you can essentially say, where are certain things going, or make a much better guess than you could otherwise. In the course of the broadcast, I've talked about Hjalmar Schacht. Well, he was the governor of the Central Bank of Germany, the Reichsbank, in the late 1920s, up until about 1929, 1930. This is Bernanke. This is somebody who, puts out word, about policies that he wants, doesn't want. He interferes in the government. Volcker has some aspects of being a Schacht. Both central bankers, as Schacht was. Schacht, of course, then went on to become the finance minister for Hitler. That's where you see where some of these people tend to end up. Go back to Weimar Germany. You find this character, Hugenberg, H-U-G-E-N-B-E-R-G. He's a right-wing media mogul who also influences a political party, the German National People's Party, the most reactionary of the respectable sort of bourgeois parties, not the hooligan, rowdy National Socialists, but the more respectable reactionary types. This is Rupert Murdoch. This is somebody who puts out a reactionary line through Fox News. All these people, Glenn Beck and so forth, O'Reilly, they're all puppets of the new Hugenberg, Rupert Murdoch. And then we've got, as I pointed out, the possibility of General Petraeus running for president along with Mitt Romney as a vice presidential candidate. I still think this is the most likely Republican ticket for 2012. We've got the Republican Southern Leadership Conference, and I would urge you to look at these people. Look at Palin. She's interested in making money. She's not a political candidate. And then we're told that Haley Barbour and Jim DeMint are serious presidential candidates. This is a clown show. This is simply a ridiculous exercise. We have this guy, Gaffney, the neocon think tanker here in Washington, D.C. He comes on the radio every night between 9 and 10 or so, and he's been talking about Petraeus as a possible presidential candidate. And you can see that the neocons are already trying to align, at least some of them, trying to align themselves with Petraeus, so they'll be present at the creation. Well, who would Petraeus be in the Weimar Republic? Of course, it would be Field Marshal von Hindenburg, the general, the military commander of Germany in the First World War, which he lost, and the Hindenburg line and everything connected with this, who then became president of Germany in 1925 and stayed there until he died as president. And he was the one who ultimately invited Hitler in, made Hitler the chancellor in January of 1933. Petraeus, and again, the advantage of somebody like Petraeus von Hindenburg is they can say, I'm not a part of these hated political parties. I'm not a party hack. I'm not a creature of the parties. At a time when parties are hated with ample justification, he could say, no, I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I may be running on the Republican ticket, but still, I'm really a national unity candidate, and I don't want to get down into the dirt of these party things. Notice that Romney did not attend the Republican Southern Leadership Conference. I think he doesn't want to be seen among this gaggle of poultry that's there. Romney is the guy with the connections to Wall Street. He's an asset stripper. He's a hedge fund hyena. And he would be, in some ways, the new Brüning. So we could have von Hindenburg, Petraeus as president, and then the de facto prime minister running the government from day to day, doing the dirty details of writing the austerity decrees, Romney. And we could go on. Interestingly enough, Hans Falada, writer, he wrote this fairly well-known book, What Now, Little Man? Was nun, kleiner Mann? Which is the story of the lower middle class, the petty bourgeois, in a world economic crisis, the continuous insecurity, the grave disappointments that come with all this. He has a book called Peasants, Bureaucrats, and Bombs, and he's writing about the Landvolk. The Landvolk are a movement in various rural parts of Germany. It's like a farmers' rebellion who, some fringes of this and various others, engage in setting off some bombs in various parts of northern Germany. And Halada had worked as a court reporter in one of these trials, so he writes a book about it, Peasants, Bureaucrats, Government Bureaucrats, and Bombs. And it's a tax rebellion. And you look and you say, well, isn't this a kind of extremist militia that then crosses over into the realm of the setting off these charges in various places? And you say, isn't there an eerie, uncanny sense that history repeats itself because people don't know what has come before, and so forth? So here's what you see in Weimar, and this it has to do with this discussion about civility and partisanship. I've tried to stress, partisanship and the violent political debate is not just a state of mind. It is a material, economic fact. It means that we reach the point where even if you're in the ruling elite, your faction is not guaranteed survival. If you were part of the Bear Stearns faction of Wall Street, you got axed. Your stocks went down to a dollar or two. If you were part of the Lehman Brothers faction of Wall Street, even worse, you got slammed. You lost big time. If you're part of the J.P. Morgan Chase or the Morgan Stanley or the Goldman Sachs part of Wall Street, you did a whole lot better, and you continue to do a whole lot better. And that's the basis of it, the triage in the ruling elite, the lifeboat ethics in the ruling elite, where they have to get together and say, who's going to be thrown overboard? We can't all survive. We've got to throw some people overboard. Or the troika, right? You're going across the Russian landscape. The wolves are chasing you, and they're gaining, and you got to throw somebody off the sled to prevent the wolves from getting you, and they're going to stop them and tear this other person to pieces. That's the mood in the ruling class, and that's why they're so acrimonious, because they know that not all interests can survive, right? If you're representing low-wage southern employers in sweatshops, then if the Wall Street characters come on the scene, it's you or them, and you know that the Wall Street guys are going to get the inside track. So therefore, a tremendous prevalence. So you get locked into this constant cycle, a deadlock. As the depression gets worse, the resentments get more. Polarization increases, the system jams up, gridlock emerges. The answer is a recovery program. Find a recovery program at the top of my website, tartley.net, and we will see you next week.